Call a meeting to order.
The House Commerce Committee, this is the 10th of April, 1979. Quorum is present.
Present are Representative Oscar Backer, and then also Representative Al Kruger, Winston, and myself, absent is Mr. Law. I'm Craig Brown, and the chairman we have before us, House Bill 35. And because of some problems in communicating with the Division of Banking and Securities, the Department of Commerce and Economic Development, we do not have anybody from the administration to testify on the bill. Supposedly, the department is sending over copies of Mr. Julius Breck's written testimony. I can figure out what all the bill's about except one section. And I'll just offer some comments right now. The bill relates to the procedures for filing fees involved with secured transactions. Up until relatively recently, I understand that the recorder function for these various things, including deeds and everything as it had been for years going back to the old territory of U.S. commissioners, was with the court system. That's no longer the case. So various places throughout the bill, you'll see references to substituting Commissioner of Commerce and Economic Development for prescribing fees for filing the index and so forth for the Administrative Director of Courts. Now, in addition to that, there are some changes made about what happens with so-called UCC instruments upon somebody paying off a debt. Section 4505774, starting in line 16 of page 1, relates to the termination statement. This is a section which is in current law in the, all these sections are in the Alaska's version of the Uniform Commercial Code, and in what's called Chapter 9, which has also been called the Full Employment Act for Lawyers, relating to secured transactions. And as it is now, the law only requires that if you pay off your bill and you require of the creditor that he sends you some kind of a termination statement, then he must. That's the current version of the language before the changes indicated in the section. This section would, changed section would instead require that he must automatically file a UCC termination in the same way that he filed your original security instrument. That is the document with which you, if you bought a car, you pledged the car itself as collateral for the loan with the security instrument. Apparently, the problem these days is that they have a lot of open-ended filings, and they don't know for sure whether those debts have ever been paid off. And it's not being done in the more orderly fashion that it is with respect to real property, where in most cases someone files a satisfaction of a debt or a release under a deed of trust or a satisfaction of mortgage. This I'm not sure about why it was drafted exactly this way. I have a couple of concerns, and I understand the Division of Banking is sending over materials. For instance, the current law says after proper demand for it, the creditor must provide the termination statement. Here, upon final payment, he must file it. But there's no statement in here that he must send a copy in the amended version, or as it would be amended, to the debtor. I'm not sure the reason for that. Also, I'm not sure why there's a change in the time period on page 2, line 2. Most of the rest of the bill is pretty straightforward. Probably the provision bill are needed. The other question I would have, if Mr. Breck were here, or when we look at the written testimony, is that are these amendments with regard to Section 774, Section 2 of the bill, are these amendments ones which are consistent with the variations in the way in which the Uniform Commercial Code is on the books in the other some 51 American jurisdictions that have it. Everybody has it except Louisiana. They still think the FOIA corrupt. I'm not sure what the answer to those questions are. It's up to the Minister Craig. Now, I just first read the bill this morning, quite up to my desk. I think I read it 3 months ago, but I don't remember reading it at all. Apparently, it's needed. And also, obviously, because of the House bill, even if it passes out of this committee, it will not be passing this year. To the extent that I can offer comments on the bill, although I'm not its sponsor, I'll answer questions if there are any.
You seem to imply that there isn't going to be any change in contract or deed of trust for land transactions because you're filing a reconveyance or something else in the package.
This has nothing to do with real property transactions at all. If it did, you would see statutory sections that would cite Title 34 or Title 9 or both. But this is all with regard to secured transactions involving personal property. When personal property can be your furniture, the thing that you bought, or you can pledge stock as collateral for a loan, any kind of thing like that is a pledge of, or a use for collateral of personal property as opposed to real property, that is land. And when you do that, you no longer use a thing called a collateral mortgage since Alaska passed the Uniform Commercial Code in 1962. Use what's called a security instrument, and you have what's called a secure transaction. And this basically relates to what happens when it's all paid off. And the other sections just provide really to the fees and the ministerial procedures and who decides that, and it's apparently no longer be the administrative courts.
Down to Section 8, and I'm curious what is repealed because the number
Title 22 is the provision about the Alaska court system. And although I did not check that, that is probably a provision related to the obligations of the administrative director of courts that's been parallel to the other section. If you have it there, you might check and see if I'm right.
Looks like you're probably going to be right.
Mr. Osterman.
Yeah, they should do something about it. They paid off a loan about 15 years ago. We can go through the whole procedure to make sure that it was paid off.
Well, very often, because the debtor is not requesting a termination statement under the present law, they'll sit there with the UCC recorded instrument for years when it'll appear from the public record that there's still a debt and the creditor and the debtor know that there isn't.
Well, the bank will give you statements that it's paid, and that loan is paid. But it's no record of the conduct or anywhere. If you have to go through, it takes about a month or over a month.
A lot of people who make, also particularly people who borrow from finance companies and things, they use this sort of thing for security transactions. They get the termination statement of the current law. They don't even know that it should be filed or that a copy of it should be filed, similar to recording any land sort of document. Therefore, there's no public record that the debt's ever been paid. And there,
unless we're lost.
Did you did we find a little hooker in the bill here?
Unless we're lost.
Oh boy, is that ever kind of antiquated.
So
some very obscure thing about recording documents relating to resident, non-resident aliens. Boy, unless we get something in writing or orally from the department explaining that one. This relates to the powers of a district court judge and magistrate. Each judge shall. And the four that they're seeking to repeal says file to the Commissioner of Commerce a copy of each conveyance recorded. This goes back to when the district court presiding judge would be involved with running the recorder's office probably, which contains a statement that property is conveyed to a non-resident alien or for the benefit of a non-resident alien. I wonder if anybody's ever checked. I mean, I've never heard of a property transaction where somebody asked if you were an alien or a citizen.
Yeah, but you know, in California now, they come out with that rule. You know that, don't you?
Yeah, I understand it's done elsewhere, but I mean, this has never been enforced.
But all at once now, down there, they decided that they have to know.
Well, these must be our materials, so maybe these will answer our various questions here. Boy, for Julius, this is short, I'll tell you.
It may be that they're repealing that thing because it's being filed now with the Commissioner of Commerce and the Court.
The district court judge no longer has those functions. That is an antiquated section, but even having anybody require that be done is...
It's like an explanation of the why.
I don't know, it goes back to the site goes all the way back to 59, so maybe it goes back to the World War II, I don't know. Somebody wrote the conspiracy. They are going to get us whoever they are.
It's obvious they have.
Probably. Don't forget the sign in the speaker's office that we look at every time in caucus. They're on the wall citing the Walt Kelly in 1971, we have met the enemy, it was us. Why don't we go off the record while the members just read the testimony that Mr. Brent would have offered orally here had he been to. We're back on the record. The members have now looked at Mr. Brent's memo, and you have being passed out for you right now the copies of the bill that he refers to in his testimony for this provision that is section 2 of the bill in front of us, the section that is 774 of bill proposed by the Alaska Code Revision Commission, which is much lengthier and in much more detail seeking to make provisions throughout the Uniform Commercial Code. And it provides a different procedure for what happens when somebody pays off the debt and terminating the terminating statement. Only thing that's inconsistent the only thing that's inconsistent about the 774 that you see from section 61 of the Senate bill is that occasionally the person charged with the recording function is still referred to as the administrative director of courts. I can tell you the source of these amendments. Apparently the administration was working on, I would imply from Mr. Breck's testimony, the administration was working on House Bill 35 to address a rather obvious problem and did not know that the Code Revision Commission was looking at amendments proposed by the Uniform Law Commissioners to all of the UCC, which also included an amendment of this section. So I don't know whether, given the way this information turned out, having this other section suddenly before the committee, if you wish to act on the bill now or not. Obviously, I'm prejudiced by pride of authorship with regard to anything in Senate Bill 55, although I forgot it was there.
Mr. Chairman?
It does seem to also put the burden on the creditor the same way that the administration bill does, but it goes into much more detail and provides for matters relating to microfilm records, that sort of thing. Mr. Randall.
Now where's Senate Bill 55 now, and is it going to be acted on?
I don't think it got into Senate rules by the 60th day.
So What we're looking at probably next year.
Well, we'll be passing the bill anyway. It's just that some of the bills on our schedule over the next few weeks will occasionally be House bills because they are bills that people want to start moving in the committee process, even though they won't be passing this year.
My point is if we amend out Section 2 out of 35, and nothing will happen in that area until 55 is passed. But.
Well, that's. Well, that might be true. On the other hand, 55 is carrying a lot of baggage with it. I will not presume to predict senators.
55 may never pass, but you know, it's a very comprehensive bill.
And Section 2 of 35 does address a real problem. Your credit rating may be harmed by somebody doing an exhaustive search on you and getting the erroneous information that you haven't paid for your boat, your snow machine, or your car, even though you did 2 years ago.
We went in past 35 with Section 2 in it, and then 55 passed with amendment.
All depends on when they would pass. We might end up giving the revisor a statute some lingering headache if they pass too close together.
Which is unlikely because we had Senator 35 here and 55 in the bill.
What I propose to do is just put this in front of the members of the committee and then bring it up on very short notice later on after you've had a chance to look at the section that was just passed out, the 774, which you see is two different ways to clean up the mess on the having these things stay on the books forever and make it look like everybody still owes their debts. And both of them are rather well drafted. Section 2 is a little bit simpler, maybe even simple-minded. The Section 61 from the other bill is very comprehensive. Mr. Magnus?
Mr. Chairman?
Did you wish to testify or observe?
Yes, if I may.
Oh, I thought you'd throw a rock at me. Well, I guess you're throwing a rock at me now.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Don Magnuson with the Alaska Retail Association. We don't have any basic problem with the concept of the bill, but we'd like to suggest some mandatory language in Section 2, probably on get about line 5 on page 2. Where now the creditor is liable for over $100 suit if he fails to file within 30 days, we would like to amend that so that in the event of loss of this filing statement in the mail or whatever, through no fault of the creditor, that the language suggested that if the affected secured party fails to send such a termination statement within the 30-day period, he shall be liable to the debtor for any loss caused to the debtor by such failure. And in addition, the secured party shall be liable to the debtor for $100 if he fails to file the termination statement within 20 days after written demand, therefore by the debtor. It just gives a little bit more leeway in the event of an inadvertent failure to file.
Do you have that prepared so that can be copied for the committee? Do you have other testimony to offer besides that?
No, that's the only area that we had any question about at all.
Okay, I have a question, a comment or two about that. Mr. Rosa, could you he'll just show you the language that he was proposing to change, and you can copy that portion of his whatever paper he has. Well, he's just talking about a different procedure and material that's in basically the end of the very long sentence.
Yeah, well, but I was looking at the other one again. Similar in the end.
Oh, yeah, the sentence. Yeah, that doesn't change the law quite as much. You'll see in the draft, in the Senate bill, page 40 of their bill, which is the second page of the Xerox thing in front of you, the only change in that section at all is just changing the word send to file, except it leaves it to current law with the $100 that he's liable for in addition to any actual loss. That's existing law.
Yeah.
And the bill before the committee would make a change in that procedure, which the Senate bill would not change very much of. Just a moment, Mr. Anderson. I have a question. I want to check something first. Have your, the members of your organization had any trouble with the current law?
No. Many of them do automatically file termination statements now.
And I know, but you might mention the other committees who typically the members of your organization are.
Well, there's about 150 retailers of all sizes, from Sears vendors down to one-man gift shops.
So you represent people who are retail sales for their small operations and also Sears and Montgomery Ward?
Right. Yeah.
What is the source of the language you're proposing?
This was drafted by an attorney for Sears Roebuck.
Okay, is that the law of any other state?
I can't answer that question, but apparently it roughly parallels what has been done in several states.
Okay, well, the reason I'm asking that is that the current law, which you're proposing to change, and Mr. Brecht is proposing to change, is part of the Uniform Commercial Code, which is, according to the nationally published document, section 9404 of the UCC. And I'm sure that at least your larger clients would not want to have a substantially different procedure in Alaska than they will then be meeting for the same sort of transaction in Washington or California or Oregon or something like that. And the question that I always ask whenever I see 4505 being amended is the proposed, and the one I would be asking Mr. Brecht if he were here testifying on behalf of this bill, is are these amendments consistent with the published draft or the recommended alternate drafts of the UCC prepared by the Uniform Law Commissioners? The reason I say that is the whole point of having a Uniform Commercial Code is that people in business, including your clients, will know that the law is roughly the same or pretty much the same when they cross the state boundary. And maybe we shouldn't fool with it much at all if there is not very much variation in this section among the various states. If there is a wide variation, then it probably doesn't matter, and I don't know the answer to that question.
I'm afraid I can't answer that either.
Since we have some time in dealing with this bill, could you find out?
Certainly.
That is that, now the bill, that the alternate language is also before us, we'd like you to look at that one. I'm not proposing to move the bill out because of the way this worked out. Right now, you have an extra copy of that. No, that's 35, an extra copy of these materials here. The ones that were copied by Karen. Yeah. If you could look at section 61 of Senate Bill 55, that is based upon language recommended by the Uniform Law Commissioners. As a matter of fact, one of the members of the Code Revision Commission, Mr. Art Peterson, is also one of the Alaskan members of the Uniform Law Commissioners nationwide. And Art, as you know, is Assistant Attorney General here. And that is alternate language that has been recommended and approved there. So you might find out from maybe the attorneys for your larger members of your client organization how much variation there is. And the citation, and the way you find these, just that you may know this, is if you look at Title 45, Chapter 5, and then if you just check the cite to Session Laws of Alaska 62 after each section, the number there is the same as the number in the Uniform Commercial Code nationwide. In this case, it's 9404. And you might find out if the language that you're proposing comes from another state or some state's variation on 9404. Quite frankly, if it's only, it would be unique to Alaska, I would not recommend its adoption by the committee, and I would have the same problem with Mr. Breck's language. Now, it may be that this is one of those remedies provisions, and we don't know the answer to this one. It may be this one of those remedies provisions where there are rather wide variations, so it doesn't really matter. The uniformity doesn't matter. And I don't know the answer to that, so maybe between the committee and you we can find out.
Well, I know they have said that there's no problem presented by House Bill 35 if it can be cleaned up a little bit. And Senate Bill 55 has also been reviewed by the attorneys, and they find no problem with it.
Oh, okay. If, so I guess I'm, my my question boils down to is the language you're proposing, the law of some other state somewhere, and if so, where, and how does it fit in with the allegedly uniform scheme of the code?
See if I can get that for you.
Any questions, Mr. Magnuson? Okay, we're going to put this bill aside, and again, I'm hoping very much that if we're able to find enough people to help Karen out, we're having some pages coming over today, that we'll be able to have your files in better order. Anything that's left on the desk before you leave today, I'd appreciate it if it's not at all obvious what bill file it goes with, that you mark on the upper right-hand corner of it what bill file is supposed to go for. It's going to be a valiant attempt made to put all of our bill files in order. Before us, Senate Bill 234, as we indicated earlier, I think off the record, we had it up. The committee schedule said if markup materials available. Mr. Rosa, did you find whether we had any materials Mr. Ward yet?
The only thing I have from Mr. Ward is my telephone conversation with him yesterday. I checked over the telephone office over there. The materials have not come in yet.
But he did say they would be coming.
He was going to send them in.
I've been in touch with Jim Ward from Central Supply, who's interested in the bill for Fairbanks, and Mr. Bedesworth, Mr. Randolph, at least, possibly other members, were waiting to get some materials. Have you been successful yet?
No, as far as I'm concerned, there's been more than ample time for me either, so I'm not going up on it.
I saw Mary Saturday here, and she hadn't received the stuff I sent for some reason.
Oh, I see.
Said she was going to, and I gave her new copies, and she was going to either work on it Sunday or Monday, and they have to be set up with that when they get it.
Well, and it looks like we may have the materials that both you and I are waiting for rather sooner, maybe sooner than our Saturday meeting.
Yes.
And I will again talk to the finance chairman about this, and I don't know whether we're having a Saturday meeting.
I was going to say, Mr. Chairman, I wish you could get that out of your head.
God, I wish I could be a part-time legislator even during the session.
It would be nice, wouldn't it?
At any rate, we do have some people who have to testify to the committee by teleconference here, and there were a few general questions that arose the last time we were discussing the bill, some rather radical general questions, among others, and they are here, so... Mr. Bisk, if you'd introduce your colleagues there, and maybe the three of you would join us up here at the table, and also Mr. Pope from the Division of Insurance. Mr. Bisk?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, this is Mr. Ray Appleby. He's a home builder in Anchorage. And Mr. Sweet Holmstrom from United Building Supply.
And you are involved in the committee that worked
yes.
on the draft as
well. Mr. Appleby is the chairman of the committee. And, I'm not a registered lobbyist, so I won't sit there, but they can. I don't want to get arrested.
You're a one-way lobbyist. You provide them information and you can't tell us anything. That's a strange rule.
It's the way the book reads.
Okay. So, I'm sorry that Mr. Malone is not here because he had one of the more shocking questions. And I think...
You can ask it.
I'll ask it in quotes because I think I have an answer for it, or I'm offered one to the committee. But, Mr. Malone just raised the question somebody ought to ask at least once and entertain a couple of answers on it. Why did he still need the Lehman Law at all? He was arguing apparently that because there are the remedies and the various revisions, including this one,
anticipate the use of some of those other remedies anyway in many cases. Why is a lien law of this sort necessary, or has the building trades and industry outgrown the lien that was seen in the 19th century?
Well, I'll let you handle that.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think the lien law is probably one of the oldest laws. Goes back to when we first became a nation. The right to lien to protect your interest in improving property has always been an acceptable law and a very necessary law, in that it's probably one of the first lines of creditability. When we as a supplier, for instance, or someone else as a subcontractor, improves a person's real property, he has a right to be paid for that property. But in many instances, payment cannot be made for various reasons. Therefore, the property becomes collateral for payment.
What would you do in a particular case if you didn't have a lien, or because of a legal problem or a deadline problem, you just thought you were going to have one, you didn't have lien rights, and then somebody's not paying you? What, I may know the answer to this, just what would you do? What would your normal course of action be in your business?
Depends on the circumstances. Each case would be an individual entity, but civil suit would be your only recourse, really, in a case like that, to get a judgment. That's really not a valid tool in that. So you go to court, you get a judgment. Perhaps there's nothing to attach there. There's nothing to secure that payment. But my feeling on the lien law is that if you improve a person's property, you know, this is the basis of a lien. If you add improvements to a person's dwelling, you're adding to the value of that. Therefore, you deserve to be paid.
Do you think that the lien law has an effect on other remedies? That is, that other remedies might be more successful because people know in the back of their heads that the lien course is available to people?
If I follow that quickly, I think that's one of the things that this bill corrects. Many times, suppliers or subcontractors, even general contractors in the past, probably relied too heavily on their lien rights and, say, granting credit to a particular organization. Many times, the owner would not even be aware that a lien was being recorded on his property. And in all sympathy to an owner, I think they certainly deserve the right to be notified that there's a possibility of a lien being recorded on their property. And I think this bill overcomes that problem, in that there would probably not be nearly as many liens recorded as a result of this bill. It wouldn't be the collection tool that many people have used it for in the past. Does that answer your question on that?
Yes, it does, in part. One of the answers that I offered, and Mr. Malone first asked that question, and I think that Mr. Dwayne Carlson also commented on it, was that the development of the lien law also was tied to the development of labor in the 19th century, and that most of the present remedies for people who have the most prior right, even under the current Alaskan law, that is laborers, in the views of Mr. Carlson and other people who are involved in it, and in my experience seeing it work. And most of the other remedies work because in the back of their head people know that the lien is available, that it could be used, and they seem to be a little more willing to pay up, even though the remedy that's actually used against them might be something from the Department of Labor rather than actually, you know, enforcing the lien rights. I want to ask a couple of questions about the bill. And Senior Mayor Mr. Halford had some questions that came up several times. I don't have any notes on what they were.
Let me tell you my problem. My problem is I think the bill almost does what it's supposed to. It probably is somewhat better than current law, and you know what I think of the current law. And but I still see the paper blizzard in the bill, and it's difficult. And it's awfully difficult to try to remedy something like that. I look at, I know you know the bill backwards, forwards, and sideways. Do you have copies up in front of you?
We have copies.
For instance, on page 3, line 5, and I've asked the question a couple of times, and people have said, hey, dummy, you know, aren't you tracking with this yet? But I may want to ask it again. I'm not yet sold on this idea for whatever our permanent solution is, guaranteed that we'll never have another lien bill come up, and this is the final answer. That having the procedure outlined in 069 of the bill, starting at line 5, is the solution. What's going to happen if the owner or his agent is on vacation in Tanganyika or is helping Idi Amin fight his war or is off in Maui or something like that? How are you going to get the authenticated copy of the acknowledgement of right to lien? Or rather, how are you going to get the acknowledgement of right to lien which was received from the owner under that section?
Well, under the particular circumstances, Mr. Chairman, I will be rather tough to get that, and it may slow down the construction process. However, you know, I don't think that it's going to happen that frequently that an owner has construction work going and would take off to help the meeting with his problems, or maybe without taking care of his paperwork before he left. And if he did, well, his project would probably be slowed down. But of course, the whole object of this section 069 was to relieve the burden of giving the notice of right to lien in a short time from the persons that were supplying material or labor and that were intended to rely on a lien right, and shift it from those people to the owner to give those people a lien right. And thereby, you know, I'm convinced that in the practical application of this thing, that many suppliers will have clients, customers, with whom they feel they can deal without the need for a right to lien. They feel like their credit is adequate and they will be paid. And they won't need this acknowledgement from the owner. So I don't think it's going to, you know, just because the acknowledgement from the owner is a tool that they can use for additional security doesn't mean that in every case they would have to have it.
Mrs. Munson?
Yeah, I have no problems with that. Simply because, say I was contracting, had a house built, and I came back with all of these statements that I was supposed to sign that where all these people would have a right to lien. If you're dealing with somebody that isn't involved in the whole thing, the reluctancy of this person who just has always heard, you know, don't sign anything you don't understand. I've got a copy of a letter here that apparently sent to Randy Phillips. And he said, he was going through different sections, and he said, this section should be repealed. How does a claimant get an knowledge of right to lien from a reluctant owner? When you're involving the owner.
May I respond to that?
Sure.
You as an owner, not directly involved in the business, and probably not understanding all of the problems that can be created in a construction project, you deserve protection. This is what we're trying to give you. I think it's very much to your advantage to know who is charging material to your property that you are going to be responsible for paying for. And if you don't know who's out there with the right to lien, You may have liens attached to your property that you're not even aware of. This gives you beautiful protection as an owner who may not really be aware of what takes place in a construction project. And this is one thing that we have really tried to address in this, is to provide protection to the individual homeowner. Builders, Ray has to be here as a home builder, he understands completely what happens in a construction project. But an individual homeowner has no conception of all of the steps involved in the project. And therefore, you're completely vulnerable to liens on your property.
All right, then going to what you were saying, that I hired him as the contractor. And I say that done. Now look, this is, you're gonna build this house. I don't wanna take care of this. That's why you're hired. What does he do with me?
Yeah, I was gonna Representative Munson, you may, and under the existing the law that we had before the revisions that were made last year, for example, you can hire this contractor and you can carry on with anything other than to give you a bill occasionally for a progress payment, and you would pay this contractor. But now that contractor or any one of the subcontractors doing work for that contractor on the job, though they had been paid, had they failed to pay their suppliers or the people furnishing labor to them, those suppliers and those people furnishing labor to them had a right to lien your property and require you to pay a second time. Okay. Now that's the risk that you had because you didn't want to be involved with it or to understand and know what was going on. The chances were very good, that your contractor through design or just poor management could collect for the entire construction process and not pay a bill, and you would pay them again to that contractor's suppliers of labor and material. Now, most owners who are out there having a construction process project done for them are not really aware of this. And even if they were, and I, as a home builder, am really in the position of an owner, up until the revisions that came through last year, I, as a home builder, had no way of protecting myself against that exposure because there was no way for me to know who my subcontractors or specialty contractors were buying from, whether they were paying their bills or not. The only way I could find out was to go ahead and pay them and then see if any liens fell from the suppliers that they didn't pay. And this is a risk that we felt the owner was not, really shouldn't have to carry. If the law can't provide a means whereby that owner can locate his risk and his responsibilities and obligations and see that they're taken care of, then it seems unreasonable to burden that owner with those responsibilities. And so what this acknowledgement, what the notice of right to lien that came through in last year's revisions did, was say that, all right, if you people want a lien right on that job as security for payment, and you're going to let that owner's property secure your payment, at least let the owner know about it. Okay? Now we're saying, since letting the owner know about it turned out to be such an onerous burden for some of the people in the construction industry, let's switch it around. Let's relieve the burden from those people of letting the owner know about it to the burden of the person who's contracting for the work, and let that person then let the owner tell you that he's aware that you're furnishing material on that job, and by virtue of that you expect the right to lien that property as security for payment for your material. But then the owner knows and has an opportunity to know, everyone out there who has a right to lien his property
and the owner knows it early enough in the construction process to see that those bills get paid. And if he chooses not to follow up, then his property is at risk, but then that's reasonable.
Well, I hear what you're saying, but at the same time, I've seen myself with these things in front of me, and I'm saying, well, I don't want to give these people a right to lien. You're my contractor. Mm-hmm. That's up to you. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to sign that. Playing out what
you're trying to predict the likely behavior of the uninformed person building the only house they'll build in their lifetime.
That's right. And all at once I'm seeing something put before me that says that this subcontractor and this subcontractor, in case you don't pay them, has a right to lien my house, and I'm becoming very fearful.
Mm-hmm. Well, would you rather be in that position, Representative Munson, or would you rather be as it was before? Well, maybe there's another solution. I don't know what it is. But where those people do have a right to lien your house, but you're not told about it. So that you have no opportunity to make sure that you protect yourself as you go through the process.
I would say that the owner should know, but I don't know if they should have to give me a number.
May I say one thing, excuse me, secondly. First of all, this acknowledgement of right to lien becomes first a credit decision. And in most instances, the person buying the material from a supplier or a subcontractor are probably going to be strong enough in their own credit right that the supplier needn't worry about a right to lien. But the thing is, if that person is not strong enough in their own right, or credit worthy enough in their own right to provide material for your house, you should be well aware that you have hired that source of a subcontractor or general contractor to build your house. That he's not strong enough in his own right to build it. It's protection for you.
I think the way the hotel works was you went to a small contractor and you were not paying him a large advance payment. He would come back to you and say, okay, in order to do this project, I'm going to have to buy the lumber from United Building Supply. I'm going to have to buy the glass from Valley Glass. I'm going to have to do this and this and this. And these people are going to have a right to lien unless you want to pay me in advance for the project because I don't have the capital to do it. But at least he's going to have told you who has that right to lien, where under the existing statute, you get virtually no protection. And on the acknowledgement, you can acknowledge only the portion or only the type you can limit the acknowledgement to $5,000 worth of lumber from United Building Supply, or in other ways, protect yourself if you're willing to do it. If you're not willing to do it, but at least you have the option.
All right, say I'm not willing to do it, then what happens?
Well, if you're not willing to sign the acknowledgement, then the individual doing the work will stop doing the work. They'll say, well, I'm not going to work for you if you're not going to acknowledge the right to lien.
Yeah, well, apparently this letter that we got is from a small...
Yeah.
Whatever he's doing.
But he wants the right to lien without having any acknowledgement, which is, it's... He doesn't want to lose any lien rights, as I read his letter, and yet he doesn't want to notify the person he wants to lien, or have the person accept.
Mr. Oster,
on one of the questions you brought up earlier, somebody said in Hawaii or something, that happened when we built that fishing camp in San Juan. I was just working. The guy took us right from left. Hawaii. They came in and I was in charge of the project. They shut us down right there. I think it was the inspector. They got him back in like 4 days, I guess. So that's one question. They'll get you back again regardless where you are. Another one, I can't think of the name of them, but you probably know Automatic Homes, Bubby. for some of you guys supplied them with material. They built a bunch of houses in Sandpoint.
What was the name of the company?
I don't know their first, they were the Automatic Homes. I think Alfred, you know them. Benjamin got a house, Jack Foster got a motel.
I know the houses, but I don't know who built them.
And, well, they never paid us. And I happened to go into Anchorage, I wouldn't have been paid at all. Well, they sold that guy, he bought that factory in Palmer, somewhere from Anchorage.
Oh, okay.
Took his airplane away. I can't remember the first name.
All right, I know you.
Now, was this lien law in effect at that time?
Not this law, no.
No, I mean, was there a
lien? There was a lien law.
Well, how did he get by with all that stuff? I think Jack Foster got stuck with about $20,000. They took the houses, and then he got that one from motel. So they still have to pay for it, Foster.
That was done, I think, because those were prefabricated. They were modulars built in one particular location and taken to another, and therefore there was not a legal description on the properties that those houses were placed upon.
Yeah, there was.
Well, yes, but at the time of the purchase, the suppliers had no way of knowing where those houses were going to be placed. So without an accurate legal description, you can't leave the property. And in that particular instance, there were no accurate legal descriptions.
Yeah, there was a legal description all along.
But the suppliers didn't know that in advance.
He didn't buy the material for a specific location. He bought the material like he bought material for inventory. And then he took the material, built the house out of it, put it on his property. Well, if this bill passed, would it help a case like that? A lot of guys, I guess I lost about $500 for a labor area. But he went broke. What he done, he withheld from everybody. That's why the state took over. And he never turned the money in. My check was under stacked that high when I got to Anchorage. It was right in the bottom, and they told me they mailed it to me. So I finally got a hold of the check, and I figured mine must be in the bottom because I'm the farthest away, and there it was. It was around $3,500. But I got that and quit, and I never got the rest of it. And then they foreclosed on me. Now, would this help in a case like that?
It would help in that everybody now is more aware of the necessity of a lien law, and I think under the circumstances a supplier or a subcontractor would be much more cautious in dealing with someone like that when they didn't have the necessary legal information prior to the sale. And I think it would alert people to probably do a little more careful credit check and protect their sale a little bit closer before they need it.
Who is the committee that worked on this bill, people representative of the industry and so forth, who's the businessman who had the smallest operation?
Art Jones, Aquatic Contractor, possibly. Like Porter, a builder and architect, maybe. Myself.
Okay, within, say, those three, how small is small?
Oh, I would say probably somewhere in the neighborhood of a gross volume of $1 million a year construction work or contracting work.
Well, let me make one comment.
Yes,
as a supplier representative on this committee, I was in constant contact with other suppliers, smaller suppliers, larger suppliers, telephone and written correspondence both, and they were, in essence, represented on this in that they were completely informed as we progressed in this, and they were asked for suggestions and comments. I believe you have a telegram, you may have seen it yet, but signed by one of the business consultants in Anchorage, along with about 40 smaller suppliers and subcontractors, stating that they do endorse the bill. And those suppliers and subcontractors were informed as we progressed within the committee. There was, as I understand it, you're seeing that the smaller organization was represented, as they definitely were.
Well, Well, that's part of it. I suppose here's the problem, and maybe you can't solve it. But years ago, the lien law, particularly if you look at what it was in the territory, was pretty simple. First life was pretty simple. Then people only had mortgages and no deeds of trust. There were very few title insurance companies operating anywhere in the United States. And if there was a loss, people just took the loss. And so you didn't quite have this many different claims of going after what would be subject to a lien or who would be liable in the event there were an error. But given that the circumstances were different, at least what the attempts were in the Western states and in the territory of Alaska was to have a lien law that was simple enough so that somebody would be able to afford himself the remedies without having to pay me $70 to $80 an hour. And are we just getting the point that Alaska business is getting complicated enough that there's no hope for the one or two man operation anymore in business? I know there's very little hope for the one or two man law office, but I'm talking about construction trade right now.
Well, sir, if I may try to respond to that.
Yeah. This is still pretty bloody complex, even though it does seem to be better than the law that we passed last year.
Yes, sir. It is pretty complicated and complex in the reading of it and in the initial understanding of it. I don't really feel like, and those that, I think Sweet will probably agree, and those that do understand it and have taken the opportunity to understand it, I don't really feel like it's that complicated to comply with from any one particular individual's point of view. I, as a home builder, have got certain steps that I need to follow in order to comply with the law and take care of my business. Sweet, as a building supplier, or building material supplier, has certain steps that he needs to follow. And I think that, as in most cases, when you get something like this for a period of time, after it first goes into effect, there is going to be some confusion and an education time and so forth. But business is going to adopt a standard operating procedure that it follows that is just the way you do your business operation. And it kind of automatically takes care of the procedures that need to be followed to give your, you know, to protect your particular business. And I don't think it's really that complicated, sir. I know we have we've made an effort to try to inform all of the home builders about it, and of course I've talked to a lot of suppliers and a lot of small subcontractors and so forth. And I find that once they take the time to try to understand it, they really seem to like it. And the response I've gotten from some small subcontractors that I've talked to over this last year was that their collections are better and they're not having near the problems that they were. A lot of their accounts that were typically 60 to 90 days before collection have dropped down to the magic 20 days that we've got in here, you know, and stop payment. And it seems to be working. And, you know, I know there are a lot of people that have said that House Bill 739 that was passed last year, the revisions that were passed last year were a big mistake because it caused a lot of problems. But I don't think that's really true. I think that as people are becoming acquainted with it, we're finding that it's straightening up a lot of problems that are in the industry and with these revisions that have been recommended this year, it's going to make it easier to do.
Do you have a question, Mr. Halpern?
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One of the things that seemed to create a problem in my district was the timing of the way the law changed last year. The effective change came out right at the beginning of the construction season. The banks didn't understand it. The small builders didn't understand it. The materialmen didn't understand it. They wrote letters to their lawyers and tried to figure out what the hell to do. I wonder if it might be wise, whatever we pass out instead of having it take effect at the end of the legislative session, right in the beginning of the construction season, maybe we should look for an effective date, something like the 15th of October, something like this, just not to change going right into the construction season.
I guess Mr. Holmstrom, if you respond to that.
I believe the revisions we've made are not that great. What we have done is stopped this paper blizzard, as Chairman Young called it. And I think it's very important to stop the paper blizzard at the beginning of the construction season. But in addition to that, House Bill 739 that we're currently working under has some serious deficiencies in it. And I'm very much afraid that if we continue operating under House Bill 739, that we're going to run into some legal actions that are just absolutely going to curtail construction financing, curtail the closing of construction loans. And I think it's absolutely essential that we get this changed prior to the construction season beginning, because there are too many inequities in the old law. And good Lord, if we dry up construction financing at the beginning of season, we're all in trouble.
A further question with the revision here. It seems that we're putting a lot of weight on the acknowledgement by the owner, acknowledgement by the bank. And in one section, we put a substantial penalty on any lender. Lender is not defined in this section, but it is defined in the statute. It's a very broad definition. It says anybody loans any money. Any lender who receives a notice under this act and is not providing construction financing to this project is obligated to answer that notice within 5 days. And if he doesn't, he picks up a penalty of $200 or actual losses. And that seems to be a pretty serious burden to place on a very broadly defined possible lender who may in no way be connected with it. It may be missent by a contractor or a supplier or somebody else to the Bank of Ketchikan instead of the Bank of Kenai. And there's some real substantial burdens there, and yet that's very important to the way this thing works. I just have trouble swallowing the liability being placed on somebody defined as a lender, whether he's a bank or an individual, as a result of somebody else's mistake.
Yes, that's true. If you check the definition of lender, it's in the main law. Most obvious dictionary definition of lender, including someone who might have no skill or knowledge at all in this area. If your Uncle Joe, sitting in Vermont, loaned you some money just because he was a nice guy and because he wanted to help you build your house.
Basically, the reason penalty clauses were written into this was because of this time element again. We found last year, and we're finding it more and more, that people are giving us wrong information. And many of them have learned now that they can give us wrong information and circumvent our lien right. And this is being done. I can show you a stack of right to lien notices that totaled several hundred thousands of dollars where I have no right to lien because someone gave me misinformation. However, we did not intend, and I would have no trouble with eliminating a penalty against the lending institution. I do believe, however, there should remain a penalty against an owner or his agent who gives you false information. That's the only way a supplier, a subcontractor, or a general contractor has to protect himself is through accurate information. But I don't think any of us would have a problem with not penalizing a lender for having lack of knowledge on it. I wouldn't have a problem there, would you, right?
No. I don't have any problem with a lender who is actually involved. If a lender is involved in some way and he's not involved in the way that's specified in the notice that comes to him, he's obviously accepted a certain liability to respond. But the problem I have is the broad definition where, as I understood it, the reason it may have gone in there was because of branch banking and in some cases it went to the wrong branch or something like this and there was no response and therefore the action wasn't taken. But it seems like a very important part of the law. I wonder what the effect of just unplugging that portion of it is.
I think you'd be amazed at the number of lending institutions who
do not acknowledge right at this time, right or wrong, they just file these right to lien notices in their files and they forget about them. And consequently, there have been some liens recorded that could turn into actual horror stories. The loans have closed, the takeout loan's been made, and lo and behold, there's a lien because the lending institution did not follow through with their particular portion of
Or because somebody gave you misinformation, the thing is on file at the wrong lending institution, and they filed it in the round file when they saw they didn't have it in their paperwork.
That's right. See, that's why we put the notification in here. Yeah, they have notified us, but I would have no trouble with removing the penalty on the lending institution.
The problem with that is if you remove the penalty, will they respond at all?
Oh, I guess
if they're not involved.
There'd be civil remedy there, I'm sure. Because the act still says they must respond.
Well, we're saying that anybody who is a lender must respond, and is responding to lien claims that you have nothing to do with, an obligation that you accept when you put yourself into a very broad classification of loaning your neighbor money to build a house. Because you're under that if you're a lender under the definition.
I would say a lending institution is a business for making construction loans should certainly be concerned enough about the industry that whether they were involved or not, they would at least take the time and the 15-cent stamp to notify someone that the information was wrong, that they weren't involved.
Yep. Well, I would hope so, especially with commercial banks, but we've got a definition problem too. I don't know, that came to me way down the line in terms of going through this thing, and other than that, I think that pretty good revision, but that really gives me some problems.
I was toying my head, and I guess it just can't work. I better say I was thinking about it. I was going to Mr. Coiner has something to worry about. Toying in my head with the idea of maybe distinguishing between institutional lenders and other kinds of lenders, like lay lenders or something. But I don't know if we don't think it would work the more I think about it. The distinction would be the example you gave a couple of times, the lender who's sitting, it is an Alaskan bank, but is sitting two time zones away from a project or something like that.
It would seem that the liability should go to the guy that makes a mistake instead of to the bank. And if somebody files false information, that's where the liability should lie. If it's the bank's mistake, it should lie with the bank. But if it goes to the wrong bank, somebody had to make a mistake to get it there. Either the guy that picked up the material gave you the wrong description, or you sent it to the wrong bank. And I would think the liability should lie where the fault lies. But the lien law is not really designed that way. The lien law is designed to allocate the liability to the guy that you can collect from the fastest. And that's why we see it go to the banks, I guess.
The owner or his agent should have the ultimate liability on providing the necessary information. And that could be addressed very easily in this penalty clause by just removing that word of person, I think it appears on page 7, line 2. You could just change that to read an owner or his agent who provides the wrong information. And you would therefore remove the penalty from the lending institution. But you would still retain the two paragraphs that state that a lending institution must respond to you. Now, if a lending institution doesn't respond, I, as a supplier, would feel that I had recourse against that lending institution, and that would be a separate thing from any lien right or anything else.
You'd sue the lending institution, and he'd turn around and sue the owner for filing false information.
He could do what he wanted to do, but if the lending institution caused me to lose a lien right because they did not respond to these two paragraphs stating they must respond, then my argument would be with the lending institution, and we'd have civil remedies there, and it would be aside from the lien law.
What if, in fact, it were the Bank of Ketchikan that it were sent to instead of the Bank of Keene?
You mean sending it to the wrong bank?
Right. And the bank at Ketchikan didn't respond. They had nothing on file. They had no idea what this was all about. They didn't know the contractors and suppliers. They weren't familiar with any of the anything to do with it. And they just round filed it.
Any astute lender should certainly respond to information of that type. When they get a document in the mail that says notice of right to lien, that's a pretty valid document. And I can't conceive of them throwing that in their own file. I believe that they would certainly respond to that and let you know that it's wrong. Many banks are doing that right now. They don't have the obligation of responding at this time, but many banks are responding anyway, just not only as a courtesy, but to protect themselves.
Before I'm afraid I'm going to have to hear in the meetings, we lost our quorum. Both Mr. Osterbeck and Mrs. Munson have gone to the meetings, but I'll make a kind of a final comment here. It's of much interest, I think, to the people from the Oversight Committee and representing the banking industry and the Division of Insurance who are here, and the committee members, if they haven't heard me already say this. At least this is where the chairman is coming from. With regard to this bill, I'm getting to the point that even though in my private heart of hearts, as the old 19th century novelist used to say, I suspect that we really should be addressing priorities again. There's not been a great support for that idea, even from the people that you would expect that wish to have the priorities changed back to what they were. And we can privately ascribe all kinds of human reasons to that. That's what must happen. So I suppose that the direction I'm going in is that 234 is probably in substance a good idea, but I would like the committee to be marking up 234 and really trying to make it do better what it proposes to do now. And that might end up, even though we're getting in a kind of a work a heavy workload here most days in the legislature now, that might end up meaning some evening meetings to mark it. And what I'm saying, at least my viewpoint, is that I want to make sure that we pass a bill that will clean up enough of these procedures so we won't have suppliers, subcontractors, title insurance companies, bankers, and lawyers pounding on our head a third and a half or fourth year in a row saying we've got to have a lien law. And I know that there's an awful lot of pride of authorship on the part of the Oversight Committee. I talked to one of its overzealous members probably on Sunday. He didn't really understand that legislators do really like to read bills before they pass them on committee, at least those in the House anyway. And that's my attitude toward the bill. I'm not holding the bill up for ransom. I'm not playing any end of the session games with the thing. We've had some complicated problems, and the committee is spread like butter over a wide range of subjects, things that the House and the Senate and others are expecting us all to do before we adjourn, and everybody wants to adjourn in the next 30 seconds, they're all claiming. But I will talk again to the chairman of the Finance Committee, who, in spite of his alleged 80-day deadline, has a strong stake in the passage of good legislation in this area also, to make sure that we're not getting ourselves into a bind. And maybe those people who have a closer ear of some members of the other body than I do, perhaps the gentleman sitting here, would make it clear that that seems to be the intention of at least the chairman. So I wouldn't be surprised if Mr. Halpert and Mr. Bettisworth would like to exchange a few more comments off the record with you gentlemen. I've got some people there we have to talk to, and we will be, if it turns out that we end up taking a long weekend after all, I might try to schedule a markup session on this bill before that time. Try to squeeze it in someplace. Richard.